It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A seven-week series of hearings kicked off yesterday to determine the future of Enbridge's plan to reroute the Line 5 oil pipeline.
That pipeline move is opposed by environmental groups and tribal leaders from the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, whose reservation the pipe currently runs through.
The case is looking at whether the Department of Natural Resources followed state law when it approved necessary permits for Enbridge to start the reroute project.
Yesterday, the first of several hearings took place in Ashland. Tribal leaders from Bad River, environmental groups, and spokespeople for Enbridge made their opening statements, and members of the public were invited to weigh in as well.
It is the latest in a long-running legal battle about the future of this pipeline.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR's Superior Bureau, where she covers the environment, energy, and news from northern Wisconsin. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, take us inside the room on the first day of this series of hearings. Hearings can be sleepy. They can be chaotic. What was the tone in the room?
Yeah, I think it was mostly orderly. You know, when I first got there, there were people lined up outside the conference center to Northwood Technical College. But there were around 200 people at the hearing yesterday. And, you know, it was for the most part pretty orderly as people, you know, signed up to speak and weigh in on their thoughts about the DNR permits that were issued for Enbridge's project to reroute Line 5.
This is a long, complicated story you've been covering for a long time, Danny. What is at stake in this series of hearings?
Well, quite a bit to the people who feel they would be directly impacted by it. You know, it's a project that kind of separates people along ideological lines in terms of our energy future and what it means to people's livelihoods, whether they are for or against it. You have labor unions, farm and industry groups that say that the oil and gas move by Line 5 is vital to the region. And then you have the tribe and environmental advocates saying that this project would bring unavoidable impacts to water and wetlands and threaten the way of life for the Bad River tribe.
I understand this is a contested case hearing. What does that mean about who is making this decision and what it affects?
Yeah, so a contested case hearing is a legal proceeding, and it's similar to a court trial. And these hearings typically involve a challenge to an agency decision. And in this case, the tribe and environmental groups are challenging the permits issued by the Department of Natural Resources for Line 5 on this relocation project. And then the judge heard testimony from the public yesterday. And when it resumes, they'll hear evidence provided by experts from the tribe, environmental groups, Enbridge, and the DNR. And they'll all make their case on whether these permits met standards when they were issued or not.
Now, this is a state process. In 2023, a federal judge ruled that Enbridge had to remove the pipeline from the reservation by next summer. How could this current hearing and this process potentially affect the timeline and possibly outcome of that ruling?
Well, that court order does require Enbridge to reroute or shut down Line 5 on tribal lands where a judge ruled that they were trespassing, but that decision is being appealed. So that timeline could change. And then this hearing will run through early October. And then I believe that the administrative law judge has, I think, between 60 and 90 days to issue a decision. And Enbridge, for their part, says that they're ready to begin construction by the end of the year, pending the outcome and whether they secure a federal permit.
Tribal leaders from the Bad River Band have been opposing this pipeline for a long time, going back well over a decade. Here's Chairman Robert Blanchard talking to you yesterday.
There's the possibility of a huge, you know, disaster. You know, it could be a huge oil spill. Could be more than Kalamazoo. I just don't want to take that. I don't want to put our lands, our people, our homes in that in jeopardy.
Referring to an Enbridge line that burst and created an oil spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. Now, we've got this reroute plan. Danny, what are the tribe's concerns about this reroute, the new map of this potential pipeline?
Yeah, well, the tribe is worried because the Line 5 reroute is upstream of their reservation, and it's still in the Bad River watershed where they have rights to hunt, fish, and gather under treaties. And so at the beginning of the hearing yesterday, it was mentioned that tribal members are beginning to harvest wild rice. You know, they call it Manoman, and this area has internationally recognized wild rice beds, and they fear that that would be damaged if there were a potential spill, and the tribe's chair said that this is their homeland, and they couldn't just pick up and move if they saw significant damage similar to the spill in Michigan.
We're talking to WPR's Danielle Kading about the latest in a long legal battle between the Bad River Band and environmental groups on one side, the Canadian oil company Enbridge, about whether the company can expand and reroute its Line 5 oil pipeline in northern Wisconsin. Danny covered the first day of this series of hearings. It was in Ashland yesterday. Enbridge was represented at the hearing, of course. Danny, what did they say to address some of those concerns being brought up here?
Well, I don't recall Enbridge making an opening statement yesterday, but I spoke with their tribal engagement director, and the company, for their part, thinks that the permits issued by the DNR were correct. They said that the agency conducted extensive study of the project for more than 4 years, and that the company designed this reroute to minimize harm, and that they believe it can be built with minimal environmental impact. And they say that any impact would be temporary during construction. And then they kind of focused on the 700 jobs that they say would be created by this project, as well as more than $130 million in local economic impact to the area.
You talked to a community member named Adam Cassino at the hearing yesterday. The Line 5 pipeline, I understand, crosses his property. Here's what he had to say.
It's a good economic stimulation for the area to do the to move forward with the project, but it's also it's the safest way to transport the product.
And Adam, I understand, contrasted with the options of moving it by truck, for example, for safety. Is this a common argument you've heard from supporters of the pipeline staying in the region?
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, supporters have often said that this is the best way to move it, you know, that it would take thousands of trucks daily if they were to transfer it through other means across northern Wisconsin and Michigan. You know, many who talked at the hearing yesterday said that they support the jobs this project would create, that they felt the DNR did do extensive review and that it can be built safely. And then they also highlighted like fears of a propane shortage or fuel price hikes if Line 5 were shut down and how that could impact homes and farms and businesses in the region. But other people focused on Enbridge's environmental track record of spills on its pipelines and just, you know, some people said that the company outright lies and can't be trusted. They said the company has failed to show enough information to regulators, and Enbridge can't just simply restore wetlands or waterways that would be affected by this project.
This is interesting. You talked to one of the lawyers from Clean Wisconsin, the environmental group, who said this case isn't really about whether or not the pipeline should exist. It's an issue of administrative law about whether or not the DNR should have issued those permits. Was that kept in focus during the hearing yesterday, or did we hear a lot more about wider debates about the role of the pipeline?
You know, I think most people who spoke during the first half of the hearing yesterday talked about jobs, the need for energy provided by Line 5, and what that would mean if these permits weren't upheld or the project couldn't move forward. That said, more than 150,000 people submitted comments to federal regulators last year opposing the project. But, you know, all of this is just the start of the hearing, and experts will go into finer detail about review of the company's plans when these proceedings resume in September.
Now, the question here is whether the DNR did the right job in reviewing this application. Have you heard from the DNR as this has been challenged, either at the hearing yesterday or elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, the DNR, for its part, defended their process. They said that they used the appropriate level of scrutiny and staff experience to examine known and potential impacts, that they engaged outside professionals and sought additional requirements and revisions from Enbridge on their plans over many months before issuing a permit, which included more than 200 conditions, you know. Environmental groups have responded to that and saying, you know, it's not whether or not the DNR is trying to earnestly review this project, that they just don't feel that it was adequately assessed because they don't have that baseline data of how this project would affect waterways and wetlands. And without that, then they can't really assess whether the services these wetlands offers, like flood mitigation or filtering pollutants, whether or not those will be affected long term.
Now we've got, as you mentioned, this is the start of a process of hearings here. In the end, if the judge says, yeah, no, the DNR got this wrong, the process is wrong, these permits are not valid, what then? What would happen next in that scenario?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately, whatever decision the judge makes based on the evidence that's presented by all sides in this, it's almost certainly going to end up being appealed and litigated in state courts. And we've seen challenges to permits go all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And so I think that this project is going to continue to face legal challenges on multiple fronts at the state and federal level. And I guess kind of the question is ultimately, will those challenges go so far that they would end up before the United States Supreme Court and its conservative majority?
And then there are other shoes waiting to drop. You mentioned the federal court. There was a ruling that's being appealed by both sides in the ruling. I understand there's an Army Corps of Engineers decision we're waiting on. What other things are out there beyond this hearing that you have your eye on?
Yeah, well, I guess like the federal permit is going to be something to watch next to, you know, and also the proceedings ongoing with this. But, you know, with the federal permit, it's not a foregone conclusion the Army Corps will issue it. But President Donald Trump's administration has made clear he supports oil and gas projects. He's directed agencies to fast track permitting them. And then we've also got like international agreements. You know, the Canadian government has invoked a 1977 treaty that ensures the flow of oil between the U.S. and Canada. So there's a lot of different moving parts in this. But I think ultimately we're just going to continue to see more challenges to this project.
Danny, we'll leave it there. Thanks for helping us juggle all these different moving parts.
Thank you, Rob, for having me on.
That's WPR's Danielle Kading, who reports on the environment and energy out of our bureau in Superior. She brought us up to speed on the latest with Enbridge's proposed Line 5 pipeline reroute. There was a hearing yesterday in Ashland with opening statements and public testimony. That next hearing will be held on September 3rd in Madison. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you ever tasted a golden oyster mushroom known for their mild, nutty flavor?
They're bright yellow, easy to grow. You might find them at your farmer's market or sprouting from grow kits that allow people to plant them at home.
They have risen in popularity in recent decades, but they're a non-native mushroom that researchers say are a risk to the biodiversity of forests.
UW-Madison researchers have a new report published in the journal Current Biology about how the species is spreading rapidly and encroaching on native mushrooms in the Midwest and harming the health of the ecosystem.
The study found that trees with golden oyster mushrooms growing on them host about half as many types of native fungi compared with trees without golden oyster mushrooms. Lead author Aishwarya Veerabahu is a doctoral student in the UW-Madison Department of Botany. Aishwarya, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When did golden oyster mushrooms first reach U.S. soil? Can you talk about their origin story here and their journey to us?
Yeah, we don't know exactly when they hit U.S. soil, right? They were cultivated in Asia. They are native to Asia, and so they've already been known as an edible mushroom there and has been cultivated there. And they were brought over to North America. We are guessing sometime between like maybe the 1980s and the 2000s. But the time when like our commercial cultivation of golden oysters really started to take off in North America, I think was somewhere around the 2010s.
Why are they thriving here? What's causing them to just explode?
I think a big part of it is that it's a similar climate and similar like mixed hardwood forests to their native range. But apart from that, we don't really know. It's actually kind of like my next project that I'm working on that will try and get closer to answering that. But it does seem to be really good at growing fast through wood. It seems to be good at creating lots of mushroom bodies in order to create lots of spores, and so very, very good at multiplying in that way. And so far, those are kind of our first guesses, but we don't quite know the answer yet, but I'm excited to figure that question out.
How did you become interested in these mushrooms and, you know, start to conduct your research here in Wisconsin? Walk us through that.
Yeah, well, I was already doing fungal ecology research when I was back out in California. And I was looking to join Dr. Ann Pringle's lab here. And really, she and some of the other scientists in the area had been noticing increased reports of golden oyster mushrooms from community scientists and, you know, citizen scientists.
Citizen scientists. Okay.
Yeah. So really, I think it was that entire body of amazing, curious people out there that saw the mushrooms and started talking about them and noticing, hey, we haven't seen this here before. What are they doing here now? And now they're everywhere. It was really this kind of word of mouth that spread about them. And so my professor kind of like clocked that. They had this project, and there was not much else that had been studied about it. The first question that almost anybody wants to know when we talk about an invasive species is, what is it doing to the native organisms, to the native community, and does it have an environmental impact?
Can you talk about that and what effect it's having on biodiversity and why we should care about this biodiversity?
Yeah, fungal biodiversity, I think we should care about purely because it deserves to exist, right? Just the fact that these organisms have been evolving on Earth for millions, billions of years, they deserve to be here, period. Like, biodiversity is always going to be a healthy part of an ecosystem. I think another big reason we should care about it is because, especially in forest ecosystems, fungal biodiversity accounts for a lot of the processes going on there. So that means wood decay, interactions with other forest beings like tree seedlings, small animals, insects, birds, right? All of these things, they depend on dead wood habitats. And so one of the things that we are worried about, yet to study it, but worried about for the future, is if we have this invasive fungus that is a wood decay fungus, so it breaks down wood, it grows on dead trees and dead wood, and it seemingly is chewing through them so rapidly and bringing them down, what does that mean for the rate of wood decay, the rate of carbon emissions from that wood decay, and the dead wood habitat that results from it that so much of the rest of forest biodiversity depends on?
I imagine you have been out to a number of forest land in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What do you notice when you get up close to these mushrooms? What do you see?
It is a startling amount of yellow, right? There's just so many clusters of golden oyster mushrooms usually covering a log or a stump that I come across.
Are golden oyster mushrooms as prevalent in other states as they are here in Wisconsin? And what about outside the Midwest?
Yes, it is outside the Midwest, and I think that it is quite prevalent in other states. I see a lot of hot spots in Iowa, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, really kind of just all of the states going across up into the Northeast. And then really around the Hudson Valley as well, which is one of the spots where we see one of the earliest observations of golden oysters growing in the wild.
Are golden oysters as a species comparable to another successful mushroom that has a similar type of story, or are they just unique in what you see among mushrooms?
There are other invasive, non-pathogenic fungi. And so what I mean by that is, if you've heard of Amanita phalloides, the death cap, it is invasive right now on the west coast of North America, and I think possibly invasive in other places as well. I know it was introduced to Australia. I don't know if you've been keeping up with a kind of a high-profile murder case that happened recently using the death cap. But so there are other mushrooms that have been successfully invasive that don't necessarily, like, they don't pathogenize any other organism. But in terms of cultivated mushrooms, right, that we eat, it seems to be the first one. And it is kind of unique in that it is the first mushroom that we've seen or that we know of that has escaped cultivation and spread so rapidly.
We're talking about a new report from UW-Madison researchers on the spread of invasive golden oyster mushrooms in Wisconsin and in other states. We have lead researcher for the study, Aishwarya Veerabahu, is a doctoral student in the botany department at UW-Madison. It seems these mushrooms prefer to live in the wood. I think I read of elm and ash trees, and many Wisconsin communities have removed elm trees due to Dutch elm disease, and more recently, the ash trees due to the invasive emerald ash borer. And I'm wondering, are these mushrooms adapting in to other trees, are they more prolific among any types of trees? What do you see?
Very unfortunately, it does seem like they are adapting to new tree species. Like, we have found it on cottonwood trees in the arboretum and so many other types. Folks have been telling me reports of seeing it on red oak, on maple. We've seen it on black cherry here as well. So it definitely is growing on other types of wood as well. But in southern Wisconsin, elm definitely is it's the most prevalent tree that we see it on. I'm not quite sure what that story is for the Northeast.
How might this invasive fungus spread differently from an invasive fish or an invasive plant or an invasive beetle, for that matter? Can you talk a little bit about the contrast at all?
Yeah, I would say that it has multiple potential modes of spreading. We haven't quite looked into that yet, but some of my co-authors at the Forest Service, they have an ongoing project trying to look at how it might be spreading, at least here in Wisconsin. They do release billions of spores. It almost looks like this smoky white haze drifting from the mushroom.
Wow.
If you come upon it when it's fresh. And so they can spread by spores that are carried along wind currents, but those spores can also land on insects and birds, perhaps, and get around that way. And then insects, birds, you know, pretty much any other creature can also carry the mycelium, like a little bite of the mushroom body, either in the wood or the actual mushroom body, can carry it to a different tree, and then it can get a foothold there. So any part of the fungal body, either the mushroom or the mycelium, can be a little propagule for it to spread elsewhere.
That's in forest land. Can you talk about how it has escaped captivity in commercial production and in these grow kits, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, we don't know exactly, and this is something, unfortunately, we'll never get a real answer for, whether it came from, let's say, like, commercial farms just going through their normal processes of, let's say, like, venting their facilities, you know, and allowing the spores from their air to get out of their facility, or from spawn, you know, like spent substrate that the mushroom grows on, like getting rid of those, let's say, like around their facility, or whether it's from grow kits. I suspect that it's maybe a combination of multiple of these things, or multiple of these sources. And the grow kits, I think, are particularly, I'm particularly worried about the grow kits just because they are a perfect package for the mushroom to be transported across the country. They could really be, you know, bought and shipped internationally and introduced to a new area with everything that it needs to possibly spread and take hold in the new place.
Have you heard of any developments in the culinary scene, like in the culinary world, whether, you know, restaurants are using these mushrooms or taking the chefs taking them off the menu. Have you heard of any developments there?
I have not. I have contacted actually one chef. I believe his name is Adam Burgo. He has a good blog online about golden oyster mushrooms. I honestly don't feel any sort of way about chefs necessarily. I hope that people don't stop cooking with them, you know? It's not that we can eat our way out of this problem, but it also does not need to be a case where we completely take it out of circulation.
Have you cooked with these mushrooms?
I have. I usually kind of fry them up in a little bit of oil and garlic, and I put them in tacos.
It must feel very conflicting in some respects, because you know what they're doing in the forest land, and yet they're tasty, they're nutritious, they have all these other things going for them.
I feel maybe conflicted most about the human component of the situation. You know, like, I feel completely neutral towards golden oysters themselves, and I think I hope everybody else is able to kind of like hold their multiplicity. Yes, they're an invasive organism, but they're also delicious. They're also nutritious, you know. They're also beautiful and charismatic, and maybe have helped people get interested in mushrooms and mycology. So, I don't feel too conflicted about eating them, that's for sure.
What role can foragers and, you know, amateur mycologists have in helping either monitor the situation or help to maybe control the spread of golden oyster mushrooms? What would you say?
They absolutely can help monitor the spread, and I think they already have been. This project would not exist without community scientists and them posting their observations on online biodiversity databases like iNaturalist and Mushroom Observer. I'm so grateful for that. I have already messaged quite a lot of people on there, so I hope one of your listeners has gotten a little iNaturalist message from me.
What information are you seeking? What are you asking in those moments?
Yeah, really just taking a picture of the golden oyster and uploading the data of where it was found. That location data is really the most important thing. It really helps me track where that invasion front is.
Are there hot spots in Wisconsin that you're noticing?
I think Madison, really just this like southern half of Wisconsin is the biggest hotspot that I see on the maps.
And as you map this data, what does that help you do with the research? Where does that take you?
Really, it helps me kind of ask what kind of conditions and climates is it getting used to, you know? Like, most recently, someone told me that they saw golden oysters in New Orleans. That's crazy far south, you know? There are observations of them in San Antonio, Texas, in the Upper Peninsula, you know? Like, spanning a really, really wide latitude range. And so it kind of helps me ask the questions of, what climates is it getting used to? What tree species is it adapting to? And where might it go next?
Wow. That temperature range in and of itself of what you said, that's very wild.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it really is. You did also ask me, you know, is there anything that foragers can do to try and, you know, help reduce the spread? The really tough thing is, like, it's not like other invasive species, you know, you were mentioning earlier. It's not like invasive fish where the unit of the fish, right, the fish's body is where it starts and ends, but that's not what it is for a fungus. For a fungus, its mycelium is throughout the wood, possibly in the soil, and so there kind of is no extracting it from the environment once it's in a place. But I do want to tell folks that if they think that they're in an area where they are possibly spotting golden oysters for the first time, like, let's say, really northern or really southern ranges, let's say, like New Orleans or Canada, those are places where it hasn't totally spread yet. And if I found it there, I would try and either contact, like, a local official who has authority over removing that wood, or if it was like on their property, I would try and remove that wood and burn it. There's no guarantee that that would get it out of the place, but it's at least an attempt.
What's the next step in the research? Where does it go from here?
I'm really excited about what I'm working on right now. I'm doing a population genomic study. And so what that looks like is I'm asking folks all over North America to send me samples of golden oyster mushrooms in the mail. We've already gotten many. Sometimes they're very stinky. And my lab mates are like, you need to get a hold of this. And then I will also be getting samples of golden oysters from the native range in Asia and trying to compare their genetics and see, is there something different in them on the genetic level that is allowing them to be such a successful invasive species here?
Aishwarya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your interest in our work.
Aishwarya Veerabahu is a doctoral student in UW-Madison's Botany Department. She is lead author of this report published recently in the journal Current Biology about how invasive golden oyster mushrooms are pushing out native fungi and how it's causing environmental harm in forests. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Ercher-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about mindfulness and recovery.
Meditation practices have been shown to reduce stress, relieve hypertension, and even help people lose weight. Can the practice also help people in recovery bring more balance to their lives? Producer Morgan D. Stewart caught up with devoted meditators in Madison to find out.
I heard that practicing mindfulness was really helpful for people like me who are struggling with anxiety, depression, and addictive behaviors. But how can I be mindful? How does one meditate? I reached out to Madison's Insight Meditation Group. They connected me with Colleen, who used meditation to help herself get and stay sober. We're only using her first name to help protect her privacy.
I had tried to meditate before I got sober. I had gone to a day-long class to kick bad habits, and it didn't stick because I had no way to access that and no way to put it into application, and I was still in active drinking. And those two just, they don't go well together for very long. You know, I was a partier. I couldn't handle the quiet, and yet I craved it too, because I did find it comforting and scary. And so then I started seeking on my own guidance, like, how does one meditate?
It was so refreshing to know that Colleen had the same question I did. How does one meditate? It seemed to be much harder than it looked. Colleen started with,
it was a meditation where they talked about envisioning yourself as a mountain. And I saw myself as a rugged, cold mountain with storms all around, because anybody who has stopped drinking or using or doing whatever it is that they are hooked on, it feels like I was in a storm constantly. And I just wanted to be grounded.
The storm whipping around all of us is sometimes referred to in Buddhism as the eight worldly winds. They are our hopes and our fears. They are four pairs of opposites: gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain.
All of it would pull me around. My bus was late. Arg, I'd get so mad, you know, or I'd get praise at work, and then that would really give me a jolt. But it didn't feel good and it didn't last. I'll never forget. I was well into a year of sobriety. I had finished a year and a half long project that I was working on. I was so happy about it. And I felt nothing once it got submitted and approved. And I went outside. I was like, I need to have a smoke. I need to have something. I need to feel something. And that was a red flag for me to step away from getting pleasure entirely out of the world.
Stepping away from what the world can offer you might sound like escapism, nihilism, or avoidance. It may sound like the same thing we were doing with our addictive behavior, but there's something different here with meditation. Dave Cresswell, also from Madison's Insight Meditation Group, teaches beginners how to cultivate what's called equanimity. During one of our first meetings, I felt I found an answer to Colleen's question. This is how to do it. This is how to meditate. This is how to become that rugged mountain in the center, feeling the winds as they roil around you, remaining unmoved.
Opening with the in-breath, softening with the out-breath.
Morgan D. Stewart brought us that story on meditation and recovery. Check out the full interview on You Humans Creative Recovery Podcast.
Gently bringing the attention back to this breathing body.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
When you think of Wisconsin fish, you may think of reeling in a prized walleye or muskie. But a new book for middle school students tells the story of saving a fish that used to be common to Wisconsin waterways, and that is the lake sturgeon. It's one of the largest and oldest fish species on the planet.
It was brought to the edge of extinction in the late 1800s, but over the decades, Wisconsin fishers and conservationists worked to carefully restore its population. Now, Wisconsin's healthy sturgeon are reviving the species in rivers around the U.S.
The book shows how young people can help protect this ancient fish that can live to be over 100 years old in the wild and weigh over 200 pounds. To learn more about the remarkable lake sturgeon, we have Ann Moser, Senior Special Librarian and Education Coordinator at Wisconsin Sea Grant and collaborator on the new middle grade book. And author Rebecca Hogue Wojan joins us, library media specialist at Memorial High School in Eau Claire. Her new book is called Saving Our Sturgeon, Protecting Wisconsin's Ancient Fish. Ann and Becky, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thanks so much for having us, Kate.
Yes, thank you. We're excited to be here.
Becky, let's start with you. Lake sturgeon are often called living dinosaurs, and it's the title of your first chapter. How ancient are these Wisconsin fish? Are we getting a glimpse of the dinosaur age?
We really are. They've been around for millions of years since the time of dinosaurs, and they've retained a lot of the same qualities. So unlike other fish who have evolved scales and bones and teeth and that kind of thing, they look pretty much the same as they did back in that day. So it's a pretty remarkable fish.
And they can get very old and pretty heavy. Can you talk about what they weigh and how big they are?
Yeah, they can live for 100 years and they can weigh hundreds of pounds. So pretty remarkable that they grow from these tiny eggs and tiny little hatchlings and develop over decades of lifespan into these giant monsters that are cruising the bottom of our rivers and lakes.
Giant monsters. And how big is big? What have you seen?
Well, I won't call them a monster because I just think that they are just really special species. And Becky's exactly right. I think that the state record for spearing in the winter in February in Lake Winnebago was over 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. That was set in, I think, 2010. I think this past winter, a young woman in her 20s speared one that was up in the 170s. So yeah, they're pretty remarkable fish that have been around from the dinosaurs and really are gentle giants more than monsters, I would say. And one of the things that drew me into thinking about having a book for young readers is they're just phenomenal species of fish.
Yes. And Becky, you really did so many interviews to bring the researchers and the conservationists, they, you know, bring them to life. Can you talk a little bit about this history when the lake sturgeon populations went from thriving in the early 1800s to the brink of extinction by the end of the century? Why was our state's lake sturgeon brought so close to extinction?
Yeah, there were several reasons that were kind of contributing. You know, they've been around for millions of years, and they were thriving in Wisconsin for most of that time until about, you know, 150, 200 years ago. And at that time, and many of our like native nations of the state just really revered them. And it was like just a staple and a part of their existence. Once the European settlers started arriving in Wisconsin, or the area we know now know as Wisconsin, that's when things started to shift a little bit. And there were kind of three main things that affected them. One is that many of those settlers found the sturgeon to be nuisance fish. They didn't like them as like fish for eating or for harvesting. The scutes on the sturgeon often cut their fishing nets. And so they were often like clubbed or, you know, removed from the lakes just to get them out of the way so that they could focus on the other fish in the lakes. The second one was just an access reason for the fish. As settlers came in, many of our rivers were dammed up for power and for all sorts of reasons. And this really prohibited, they didn't know at the time, but it prohibited the spawning and the movement of the fish, not just of sturgeon, but a lot of other fish too. And sturgeon are a species that needs like miles and miles of river to be able to propagate. So that really affected. And it wasn't something that people noticed right away because sturgeon have such a long lifespan, but it was making it so that those young sturgeon weren't being born. And then the last one is in the late 1800s, refrigeration coming into being, there was a fad for caviar, and people were able to ship sturgeon eggs to places further than they normally could have. So suddenly it was seen as black gold in the state of Wisconsin. And so thousands and thousands and millions of fish were harvested for their eggs. And that took a huge toll on the sturgeon population.
We're talking about a new children's book and efforts to save Wisconsin's lake sturgeon with Becky Wojahn, author of Saving Our Sturgeon, and Ann Moser is here, the senior special librarian and education coordinator with Wisconsin Sea Grant. Ann, you've looked very closely into the dams and the impact on spawning, the impact on habitat fragmentation. Can you talk more about that?
As they were building the dams, they weren't really taking into consideration the fish, the species, as Becky described. It takes a really long time for the female to mature, to spawn. So, you know, an average of like 20 years old before they have their first spawning experience. And then they only spawn every 5 years. So when something happens to a lake sturgeon and it has been impacted, it takes a really long time for that to be understood and also to see the impact. So when they built all these dams with no fish passages, we're still seeing the effects of that today because they still have not completely recovered because of that. But what's interesting and what I think Becky really tells really well in the story is the different story of the Lake Winnebago system, because that's really what this book is about, this remarkable ecosystem in the Lake Winnebago system. And so it's a perfect ecosystem for these fish with all these beautiful rivers where they go up and spawn, the Wolf River, the Fox River, the Embarrass River. It's a beautiful lake and the rivers go off, but they didn't put dams right away on some of these spawning rivers. And so for a while it was okay. They eventually dammed the Lower Fox River. And so what happened was suddenly this Lake Winnebago system became this sort of perfect system where the population, you know, all those things that Becky had been mentioning weren't necessarily happening to this one population. But they were still under a lot of stress, habitat destruction, all of that stuff. So dams were kind of a different effect for the lake sturgeon in Lake Winnebago system. And that's why the story of that particular fishery is so important, because it's a closed system. They can closely monitor it. They can get a lot of data and have a really good understanding of the science of how to protect lake sturgeon. So in a way, sort of the dams are kind of a positive for this one particular species. But that's not what scientists want. They want the whole entire Upper Great Lakes to have more lake sturgeon. And so we're learning lessons from the Lake Winnebago system that they can use all around.
And, you know, toward the end of the book, there are so many ways that young people can get involved in preservation efforts with lake sturgeon. Can you talk about one that comes to mind?
You know, the greatest thing you can do is have an experience where you get to witness these fish, right? You know, one is in September in Milwaukee, they have a big harbor fest, and part of that includes a release of lake sturgeon. For those that live in the Milwaukee area, go down there, watch this happen. They're raised at River Edge Nature Center, and then they release them. And to see these fish in front of you is just a remarkable experience. Other kind of in-person experiences, you can go in winter, go up to Lake Winnebago. You can go to the registration tables where they're registering the fish that are caught, and to talk to people about their experiences. It's unbelievable. Like, I describe this to my friends. I'm not from Wisconsin, and I tell my friends and family, and they're just, no, they can't believe it. They're just an incredible experience. And at the same time, you can go up to the Shawano area where they spawn. And that's even more remarkable, because here are these fish just coming right up next to you, doing their spawning. You can basically reach down and touch them. But to see them live like that is incredible.
Well, Anne and Becky, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Becky Wojahn is a high school librarian in Eau Claire and the author of 18 children's books. Her new one, it's called Saving Our Sturgeon, Protecting Wisconsin's Ancient Fish. And Ann Moser is a senior special librarian and education coordinator at Wisconsin Sea Grant. She collaborated with Becky on the book and inspired her to write it.
Do you have a story to share about seeing or catching a lake sturgeon, or maybe the one that got away? What was it like? Email your story. You can also share a picture of said sturgeon with us at Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. That email again, Wisconsin Today at WPR.org.
On the show next week, we'll be looking into the economic impact of skate parks in local communities around Wisconsin and the Midwest. Our guest is an economist from UW-Eau Claire who is a skateboarder himself, working on his flips and grinds and ollies. I'm trying out some of the skateboarding terminology, Rob.
Well done. And while Kate does that, we want to know if there's a skate park in your community. What's the story behind how it came to be? Do you see the skate park getting used, maybe by you or your kids? How is it maintained? Does it have lights or other amenities?
And what do you think of skate parks in general as a feature in your community?
Leave us a message or send an email about skate parks. The email is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You could also call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today rad producers include Rochelle Wilson, Beatrice Lawrence, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Lee Rayburn. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.